Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 7, Trading and Investment Practices Affecting Hedge Funds. David Serignano and Amy Kroll will discuss the current trading and investment practices relevant to hedge funds. Now, on to the podcast.
I'm going to begin with a refresher course on the 13DG reporting scheme, particularly the common but tricky issues faced by large activist investors, including when you are eligible for a 13G, when you have to switch to long form 13D, when you have to report group issues, and when you have to report plans and proposals to affect change at public companies. Fortunately, we have a recent SEC enforcement action that goes through many of those issues, and so I will start off focusing on that. I will also address some SEC initiatives in the activist area, including universal ballot proxy proposals that came out late last year, and the current status of proxy access. The case I want to focus on is In re Eberwein case that came out in February. It was an administrative proceeding brought by the SEC, essentially under Section 13D of the Exchange Act and under Section 16 as well. The decision doesn't really break any new ground, but it is a good case study on how these issues get presented and how the SEC views them. We're essentially a group of five investment managers who manage a variety of different types of accounts, from private funds, separate accounts, family offices, as well as one advisor was a public registered fund manager. The SEC's findings go out of the way to point out that these people have an ongoing close relationship with respect to a number of past activist initiatives. In fact, the findings in this case relate to five different public companies. To file on a short form 13G, of course, you all know you have to make the certification that you purchased for investment purposes, not with the purpose of influencing or affecting control and in the ordinary course of business. The respondents initially filed schedules 13G for several companies or didn't file anything yet because they were relying on the delayed filing permitted for institutional investors that essentially allows them to report the 5% positions at the end of the year. But during the course of that year, they became involved in certain control-related matters and failed to timely switch from the 13D to a 13G. That's a difficult issue. When can you no longer make that certification? When are you holding for the purpose of affecting control? One rule of thumb that I like to apply but doesn't really appear anywhere in the statute, that is, if you're a 13G filer, but you find that you now have a plan or a proposal that had you been on a 13D, you would be required to disclose that under item 4 of Schedule 13D, the plans and proposals items. There's a good chance that it's probably time to be thinking about switching from a 13G to a 13D. These matters include acquisitions of additional shares. Certainly, if you're thinking about acquiring a control-related position, then you probably should not be making the 13G certification anymore. Proposals to change management or the board, acquisitions, causing the company to engage in acquisitions or dispositions of assets or engage in business combinations, changing the capital structure, changing the line of business. If you are actively pursuing a plan or proposal to cause those type of changes, chances are you don't belong on a 13G anymore. And that's switching from a 13G to a 13D is tricky because there is a cooling off period. It's often referred to as the 10-day cooling off period during which you can't buy any additional shares. You can sell, but you can't buy, and you can't vote during that period. 10 days is misleading because it's actually 10 days following the filing of the 13D. So you get 10 days from this change in subjective intent to this control purpose. to file your 13D, and then you get 10 days, then you have to cool off for 10 days after that. So possibly up to 20 calendar days of being subject to that cooling off period. So it's something that you have to do with your eyes open and do intentionally. One troubling aspect of the decision was the commission's finding that recommending nominees to the board for the board's slate, then not doing an opposition nominee, but providing names to the board, was enough to throw these respondents off the jig. Hopefully that isn't taken too far. Many public companies have procedures where they encourage shareholders to provide suggestions for the board to consider as possible nominees to the board. In this case, the company actually put out a notice that it was soliciting suggestions from its large shareholders. And these managers did submit names, and the SEC said that they should have switched from a G to a D when they submitted those names. But I'm concerned that people will take that as a clue that when you can't make suggestions to the board, even at the board's invitation, for new personnel on the board without losing your G status. I don't think that's what the case says. I think the case is more concerned with having the hidden motive of essentially causing a change in control through a board change, not merely meeting requests of management to provide names of good candidates for the board. The requirement to disclose your plans and proposals is not just related to activist matters, but it can come up to in a number of contexts, even a decision to or encouraging the company to engage in certain kind of financings, pipe transactions, and the like. So, you know, how it's a very difficult question. How does a 5% plus holder engage with the company on routine financing matters without having to disclose what everybody would agree would be somewhat prematurely, the plans and proposals to do those matters very early in the negotiation stage? That's difficult. It's one reason to stay below 5% if you plan to do those type of transactions. But once you are over 5%, either as a G filer and have to worry about switching to a D, or if you're on a D, having to amend to report these plans or proposals, it's a very difficult issue. You know, when does it become concrete enough? When does it, do you need some buy-in from the other side before that is required? You know, rubber clauses you see in a lot of the filings saying that we may do this, we may do that, gets you a little bit of wiggle room to engage in preliminary negotiations. But the SEC has said many times that it doesn't get you all the way home. And when they see the first disclosure of a major transaction being that they have an executed agreement and they were dealing with a 5% holder, then they will say something's wrong. This couldn't have been negotiated without having plans or proposals that should have been disclosed. The case also involved a number of group issues. The problem with groups is that you have to aggregate all the holders in terms of triggering the 13D reporting obligations, as well as the Section 16. In this case, when they aggregated all the group members, they went over the Section 16 threshold. So even though individually none of the group members were insiders in the sense that they were 10% holders for Section 16 purposes, each one was separately subject to the reporting and liability provisions of Section 16 of the Exchange Act, the short swing profits provisions. And so you can get very draconian results when you aggregate over the Section 16 limits. Leaving the Eberwein case now and just focusing on some SEC initiatives, believe it or not, it is not possible for an investor, an institution, to mix and match slates in a proxy contest to pick some nominees off management's card and some nominees off the insurgent's card to put together what they would view would be the ideal board. Because of a quaint notion as bona fide nominee, in which an investor, a director nominee is deemed to have consented to serve only if the right people are elected with that person, the SEC has not permitted that kind of mixing and matching. There was somewhat of a Band-Aid fix in 1992, in which the so-called short slate rule was adopted that allowed an insurgent to put up a non-minority slate and allow them to fill out the minority slate by people from management slate who they They could only tell the investors who they will not vote for. They couldn't tell them who they would vote for. It's a very strange rule. There's been a push in recent years to get rid of that silliness and adopt a universal ballot or universal proxy, which essentially allows you to do by proxy what you could do if you were physically present at the meeting where a ballot is distributed with both slates on it. That was proposed last December, by the SEC. It was an issue championed by Mary Jo White, the former chair. The new chair, Jay Clayton, has not addressed the issue yet, so it's not clear whether this would be pursued. I am going to save some time for Amy and let her pick up.
Okay. In that case, we're going to jump ahead. Trading issues. I'm going to briefly touch on three, maybe four, very distinct issues that, although issues that are really in the Securities Exchange Act and one would think are broker-dealer issues, will or can impact private funds. The first is Rule 105. For those of you who are not familiar with 105, please come see me after this session. Rule 105 is part of Regulation M, and it is the rule that imposes what is in effect a flat prohibition with a few limited exceptions on a purchaser receiving an allocation in a public offering, a firm commitment public offering, if they have a short position during a 5-day restricted period prior to the allocation being made. And there was a flurry, if not an avalanche, of enforcement cases over several years. It slowed down a little bit, but it really highlighted that nobody is immune. Private funds were subject of these enforcement actions. Investment advisors were subject of these enforcement actions, as were broker-dealers and even some private investors, some individual investors. All you need is one purchase and an allocation to constitute a violation if you have a short position and you aren't able to rely on one of the limited exemptions. So why am I raising it now? The enforcement case flurry is over. Good time, if you haven't already, to go back and look at your funds and your advisors' policies and procedures to ensure against 105 violations, to ensure against receipt of allocations when there's a short position in place. Similarly, go back and take a look at your monitoring processes to make sure that in the event there's a short position on, there isn't an allocation, a receipt of allocation that slips through. That's especially important if you have multiple funds that may make their own investment decisions but that share portfolio managers, for instance, so that they're really not independent. Because one of the exceptions is for separate accounts that make independent decisions. But if you share in a portfolio manager, it's going to be very hard to argue that decisions were independent of each other. So good time to go back, check on policies and procedures, check on monitoring systems for ensuring compliance with those policies and procedures. The next point I'd like to touch on is some of the FINRA examination priorities. Again, why would this affect private funds? Because FINRA is looking at a number of trading activities that are likely to have, where their trades have likely been put on by private fund clients, by hedge fund clients. So FINRA is looking at product surveillance tools. It's developed cross-product surveillance tools to detect layering in underlying equity in order to influence options prices. They're doing cross-market surveillance, in fact, for cross-product manipulation. And they're doing it not only with equity and options, but they're looking at ETFs and other exchange-traded products. They are actually sending out what they're calling report cards, which apparently are truly changing the way that firms are acting to identify layering and spoofing. They're looking for best execution. They're using technology. You heard Ivan and Mary Jo speak about the SEC's development of technology sophistication. FINRA is the same. They are gathering data, analyzing data, and making decisions about data, and that's going to come back. Your trades are going to be fed into the FINRA system through your whom you execute your trades through, and they're going to be analyzing in order to make decisions about whether best execution is being provided and other order handling decisions. There's also surveillance for trading in fixed income securities, something that's a little bit novel if you're old enough to remember when fixed income was telephone driven entirely, but again, there's technology now to facilitate that kind of more intense facility, and to facilitate that more intense surveillance. And finally, trace reporting in US government securities is a new addition to the universe of the reporting in fixed income trading that FINRA requires firms to engage in. So all of those are areas where, depending on what kind of trading you do, your trades are going to be the subject of this kind of FINRA surveillance. The last topic I'm going to speak about very, very briefly is broker status. Why am I talking about that? Private funds like to market their products, but marketing of private funds potentially raises the possibility that those who are doing the marketing on behalf of the funds are themselves broker-dealers if you haven't retained the services of a broker-dealer placement agent. This has become an issue of some focus by the SEC in recent years. The Black Street Capital Markets case that, again, Mary Jo and Ivan spoke about at the beginning of the morning raised this issue. They received compensation that FINRA determined was transaction-based compensation, and that was in the context of transaction fees, but you also have the issue in terms of marketing fees. With that, we are out of time, and we appreciate having the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.